Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, celebrating 30 years as local hearing healthcare professionals. With a practice featuring 5 doctors of audiology, including 2 who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Ameren, Illinois, says it wants to be a player in the expanding electric vehicle business. The utility just announced plans to help build out a network of public charging stations. Ryan Denham speaks with Ameren's Senior Vice President of Regulatory Affairs and Financial Services, Teresa Shaw. Shaw says Ameren is in a unique position as a utility.
Building infrastructure, that's what we think we do best. We've been around for 100 years, and when you look at the wires and the poles and substations, you know, that's what we build. And we're partnering with our union labor force that do such great work. This is work we know how to do. We also have very smart engineers. They know where we have capacity in our system. We're best to locate chargers. We're an investor-owned utility, so we can get funds from investors to help fund these big projects. And what I think makes us unique as utilities, we have an obligation, and I consider an honor. We serve, required to serve anyone in our service territory. So when we think about charging infrastructure, we want to make sure it's accessible to everyone, that everyone gets to benefit from the cleaner air, from electric vehicles. And so we're especially focused on disadvantaged areas and under-resourced areas as well.
Now, has Ameren ever done public charging stations like this in the past, or is this your sort of your first foray into that?
This would be our first foray in this type of project. And to be clear, to do this, you know, we are a regulated entity. So we believe we're going to need, we've committed to this, but we said that it's subject to getting regulatory or legislative approval to do that. But we have a couple things in the pipeline. We are supportive of, it's called the Downstate Clean Energy Affordability Act. It was introduced this last spring, hasn't been heard. We continue to support this bill. It does a lot of things supporting renewable energies, but a part of this bill is to jumpstart electric vehicle market. And it includes giving us the ability to provide incentives for third parties to come in and build charging infrastructure, or would allow us to build as well if others aren't coming in to build. So we're hopeful that that legislation we'll get traction, as you know, the governor and many of our state legislators are very focused on energy policy right now.
So for those charging stations coming into Illinois, what kinds of places do you intend to put them?
You might be interested to know, we have about the lower two-thirds of the state of Illinois, which is maybe about the size of Indiana. We only have 60 publicly accessible charging stations in our entire service territory right now. And we only have 3,400 electric vehicles. So that, I think, again, they kind of go hand in hand, right? Again, I said we're going to have to work with our regulators and other stakeholders that are interested in this to file a plan where the charging corridor would go. But I'll share with you our vision. We would want to see chargers at major intersections on all of the 9 interstates that go through our service territory. So that would include I-74, 55, I-39. We'd also want major routes as well, to make sure we have good coverage. We haven't set a certain number yet, but to give you some perspective, it's, we think, to feel comfortable, usually they suggest every 30 to 50 miles you would have a charger. And I don't think it would have to be a lot, but it's just enough to make people comfortable. They can hop on 55 and not lose any power in their car.
Well, more electrification of vehicles will mean more demand on the grid. Can you talk, I mean, big picture about how ready or not ready our grid is for that kind of reality, and what do we have to do to get there?
Yes, great question. You know, we are very ready. We have, over the last several years, due to the IEMA Act, that was really forward-looking legislation passed several years ago by our General Assembly, to invest in our grid. It's smarter. It's more reliable. It's been built to have more two-way flows of communication, and that's where renewables come in, and that's where electric vehicles come in. So we've been building our system the last 10 years to be ready for this type of technology to come on to our system. Electric vehicles, we're ready. We continue to invest in our infrastructure. And this is kind of the really interesting part about why electric vehicles, it's kind of one of these win-win-wins. One of the rare topics where most people can agree on these days is how electric vehicles, it's good for the environment, but it can be good for customers because, you know, if you can, it's called demand management. If you can really incentivize people to charge at the right times, you can actually drive down our per unit cost of electricity for all customers. And, you know, what do I mean by optimizing the use of the grid? So, you know, our infrastructure, it is designed, our distribution infrastructure. So when you look at our wires and our poles and the substations, it's designed, always has been designed to meet our peak customer need on that hottest day of the year, which is usually in the afternoon. So when you come home and it's 100 degrees outside and really humid and you can turn all your lights on, all your appliances are on, you can charge your phone, you can watch television, and you don't have to worry about your power not being on. That's how we designed the system. We wanted to make sure you have power on those days. So that's how our system's built. So that means we have capacity on especially non-peak times, which for us is usually that 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. That's one of the things that filing we have with our regulators is to offer certain, sometimes you hear it called time of use rates to incentivize people to charge in that off-peak time. So maybe from 11 to 7, charge your car so it's ready to go in the morning. And you're helping us spread out our costs or bring more units of electricity sales. And then we can spread all of our kind of fixed costs over more units, driving down costs for everybody.
That's Ameren Illinois Executive Teresa Shaw speaking with Ryan Denham. Ameren also says it plans to electrify its own fleet with a goal of all light-duty vehicle purchases being electric by 2030. Shaw says Ameren has already pre-ordered several Rivian trucks.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on WGLT, and we're taking a quick break to talk about Fall Fun Drive. I'm R.C. McBride, joined by Melissa Leibert to talk about why now is the time to help your public radio station. Contribute at WGLT.org. It only takes about 60 seconds to get it done. And think about how good you will feel afterwards.
We've all been challenged in different ways over the past several months. Disruptions to our daily schedules, routines, employment, and health. And through it all, our team has remained here for you, focused and working tirelessly to keep the news, information, music, and entertainment coming your way. And you might be consuming the news a little differently right now. Maybe you're not listening at work and you're not driving as much. Instead, you're streaming from home. Do you find yourself catching up on local news on our website or the podcast? Perhaps you're a super user and it's all of the above.
However you're doing it, you're connecting with your community, with news, conversations, entertainment. That's all enriching. This is an essential public service, and it takes the work of many to get the news delivered in whichever way you choose to consume it. Be part of the team that makes it happen. Contribute now at WGLT.org.
WGLT has a long record of award-winning quality journalism, and I'm sure that's why you're tuning in right now. This year alone, WGLT was honored with 8 AP awards, including first place honors for outstanding news operation. And WGLT captured 3 highly coveted and very competitive Edward R. Murrow Regional Awards. This level of journalistic excellence doesn't just happen. It requires rigorous investigation, strategic hiring, expanded training, mentorship, and a commitment to seeking truth, as well, of course, as appropriate equipment and technology to get it all done and bring that news to you.
WGLT cannot continue to bring you this level of coverage and quality without your support. So contribute today and show your commitment to this essential community service you rely on, especially now when live, local, and trusted news is so, so critical. Go to WGLT.org right now and make that critical investment. And thank you.
This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In an unusually uncompetitive race for U.S. Senate in Illinois, there is unusually harsh rhetoric coming from a major party candidate. The contest between incumbent Democrat Dick Durbin and Republican Mark Curran is on no national watch list at all. Tim Shelley reports, though, Curran's tone in the campaign is strident and contrasts with his approach during the primary.
Republican Mark Curran is a former sheriff of Lake County. During a crowded primary early this year, Curran promised he would be the one to attract voters from across the aisle. Now, not so much. During a virtual town hall for Central Illinois Republican voters, Curran said Black Lives Matter is in bed with the abortion industry and the defund the police movement.
Black Lives Matter is an evil entity, and I've never supported Black Lives Matter.
He tried to undercut African-American support for Democrats. Curran says the Democratic Party harmed blacks through public housing policies and support for Planned Parenthood clinics in inner cities.
They've done everything to kill the black family.
Curran claims President Trump is changing that through criminal justice reform. And Curran attacks Durbin's record on work for minorities.
You go to East St. Louis, Illinois, where Dick Durbin grew up, and I would submit to you that may be the worst city in all of America. I've never seen anything like it.
East St. Louis has a high murder rate and steep population declines over the last half century as the manufacturing sector declined. Political scientists say not so fast. Bob Bradley, a retired Illinois State University professor, says Curran's attacks ignore Democratic Party efforts to improve access for blacks to voting, education, credit, and safe housing.
All those types of things essentially come from a variety of governmental programs that essentially Democrats push through.
Lane Crothers is another Illinois State University political expert. Crothers says Senate candidates usually run more towards the center in a state like Illinois, which has both large urban and rural areas.
People tend to be compelled to run a somewhat more moderate line, if only because they need statewide support if they expect to win a statewide office.
That was the stance taken by Senator Mark Kirk, the Illinois Republican and social moderate defeated by Tammy Duckworth in 2016. Bob Bradley says that logic may no longer hold true, even in a diverse state like Illinois. He says such sentiments aren't outside the Republican Party's mainstream today.
I would be astounded, except I've heard similar things by other people running for federal office.
Bradley says Republicans have embraced candidates like QAnon supporter Marjorie Taylor Greene in Georgia, who espoused similar talk. Until recently, accepted political wisdom avoided violent rhetoric and personal attacks directly from a candidate. Campaigns have traditionally used surrogates on the attack. Curran violates that norm as well.
Dick Durbin is really not a good guy. He's a really, really bad guy. And I don't say that people, you know, just because they have a D next to their name, they're, you know, bad. You know, a lot of them just don't get it. But this is a guy that right. He would cut your neck and sleep like a baby.
Curran says while the political left has taken to the streets, America hasn't yet seen the right fully roused. But he says it's in the DNA of the more politically conservative central and southern Illinois, quote, not to go down without a fight.
You know, maybe secession of portions of this country is in our future. Who knows? I don't know. But I'm going to tell you this much. They're not going to go quietly in the night. They're not ready to surrender. This is their America.
Political scientists suggest Curran's remarks are in keeping with the more strident, belligerent tones Republican candidates have adopted over the past decade. Lane Crothers says those words approach something from QAnon or the far-right Proud Boys, almost.
There is this spectrum of our politics out there of some very angry, very aggressive people who are very, very close to engaging in or calling for actual violence. And that's a very different kind of United States if we go that path.
Curran suggests he can sweep the southern two-thirds of the state, pull off victories in the collar counties, and perhaps even secure 25% of the vote in heavily Democratic Cook County.
Our message, send a sheriff to Washington. Send a sheriff to Congress? I mean, that resonates with people.
Other Republicans acknowledge Chicago suburbs and collar counties are the key to any statewide race. They also say it's a tough year there because President Trump has lost a lot of support from Chicago suburban women. Curran had just $35,000 cash on hand at the end of the last reporting period. He acknowledges he doesn't have the cash to launch a major ad blitz. In a statement, Durbin's campaign says comments like Curran's would have sparked a resignation from high office not long ago. The Durbin campaign manager says he'll be on the lookout for Curran's social media posts if he, quote, continues to rehearse his best Donald Trump impersonation. I'm Tim Shelley.
When asked for additional comment, the Curran campaign said the full candidate quotes transcribed are accurate. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The McLean County Health Department is praising a new software program from the state it is using to handle contact tracing. In part three of WGLT's series on contact tracing during the coronavirus pandemic, McLean County Health Department Communicable Disease Supervisor Melissa Graven tells Eric Stock the program comes at no cost to the county. It's been easy to use and helps them harvest more data to develop a targeted public health response.
They did a very nice job of laying out what counties were coming in what order. They kind of pre-prepped us. They kind of trained super users, so I was the super user on site and the tech advisor, and then I had about a 1 or 2 weeks of getting that used to that under my belt, and then the software went live in our jurisdiction, and we did some training beforehand. They did some live demos and webinars where we could ask questions and answers, but then the switch flipped and we were going to Salesforce. That's the program. And I have to say the staff here did an amazing job of working through it very quickly, completely different program than what we're used to. And at one point we were double entering into two programs so that we made sure none of that information was lost and was transmitted over.
How is it better than the program that you had been using up to this point?
I think I can say with good confidence, most of us here think it's a great program. It's logical, it flows, it's capturing a lot more information in one spot, and it's got a system on the back end that we can pull that information back out that's meaningful.
So if a contact tracer makes a phone call and gets this information, I presume they're entering the data as they go.
Correct.
How much data entry is involved in that process?
So it depends on the tracer and their process. There's a lot of tracers that are proficient. They have a headset and they can type in as they go. Some need to like jot those notes down on a piece of paper. And then once the conversation's ended, they then immediately put it back into the program. So we try to make it just a one-time entry as opposed to multiple entries into two systems. So coming over to Salesforce has really minimized the double documentation we've had to do.
What are you looking to glean from this software, if it makes it easier to do this, that will help McLean County and possibly other health departments manage these sorts of outbreaks in the future?
So having access to the information in a way that the reports are pretty easy to use, it's just understanding the system allows us to see in real time what was the change from yesterday to today and what our case demographics look like. Where are we starting to see the shifts in the community? We're seeing 60-year-olds last week, but now we're starting to see 30-year-olds. And what's great about the program too is we can kind of log the locations of where people visit, so we can then run reports to see, are we seeing locations come up and maybe starting to see something brewing where we can target messaging or resources or reach out to that location about what's going on there, that we're seeing a lot of people naming this location as a place that they visited or been, or the activity. Is it the activity that they're doing that we might see a higher risk of transmission related to other activities?
So is that information easier to glean than it was under the previous program?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. It's just a matter right now of us trying to all wrap our heads around it and pull it out and getting it so we can get it quickly.
Is it more efficient in that regard? Are there workflow efficiencies that you've discovered beyond that for the contact tracers themselves, perhaps?
I would say any work, as we've gotten more tracers on, which is amazing, we're getting to more people quickly. We are more spread out, so it can make it difficult to communicate amongst all of us at once and share messaging. But what I will say with Salesforce is that we can get in and access that information pretty readily. So if we know who we need to talk about or find something, we can look it up in the system amongst us as users, so that somebody working on third floor can see what somebody on first floor is doing, so they can help that person who calls back. They may not get the same tracer they talk to, but any tracer can help them. So it makes it more efficient in that way. It also helps that we're training contact tracers to also be case investigators. So the system allows for you to move back between those two different roles that you're doing very seamlessly. So a case investigator can investigate you as a positive person and then get all the information on your contacts all in the system, and you can move on. You don't have to bounce between different systems.
That's Melissa Graven from the McLean County Health Department with Eric Stock. Graven says the Salesforce program would also be useful to track other infectious diseases and foodborne illnesses, but it's not clear if the state will offer access to it after the pandemic. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University Athletics Director Larry Lyons is preparing to retire from the university at a time when the pandemic has forced nearly all sports competition to be canceled, at a time of racial unrest. His recent comments that all Redbird lives matter became a flashpoint as student athletes and some coaches pushed back and demanded change. Lyons says some of that change was already in the works, and the action plan he implemented is laying the groundwork toward culture change. He tells Eric Stock the department has started racial diversity training for coaches and support staff, and it's working to establish a committee of student athletes to give them a platform to foster change. Lyons says it's change the university has begun to address campus-wide.
How do we integrate the athletic department planning and the overall university planning for diversity, equity, and inclusion? And we will be part of that, and we want our student athletes' voice to be part of that as well. So there's a big picture here and a small picture, and I feel like we're taking some really good steps right now. And it's something that's going to take some time. You just don't put things in place right away. It is going to take some time, and then you're going to have to tweak some things. Some ideas you thought were good ideas may not be as good as what you thought, and you need to be responsive for those when things do change. And then obviously we've got to be really intentional about when we have open positions. How do we have a diverse pool and then hire the best person to fit into whatever the duties of that position are?
And do you feel that the athletic department, the coaches, are all on board with the movement? And I bring this up in light of what happened regarding Kurt Beathard. And I understand that you can't comment on personnel matters, but he had been the football program's offensive coordinator. He left after there was a sign on his door saying "All Lives Matter" to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Now, he says he wrote it. Someone apparently took down a Black Lives Matter poster in the football locker room, and he says it wasn't him. But do you feel that there's any friction on this issue of moving forward, or is this sort of an isolated incident that's already been addressed?
Well, you're right. We're not going to comment on that particular incident, but I will tell you, I think there's a commitment with our head coaches, with our assistant coaches, and with our athletic department staff to make this place better, to be more diverse, to manage equity and inclusion for the betterment of the athletic department, but for our student athletes. And I don't think anybody is looking at that as something that's not a good thing, and it will be a positive when it's all said and done, because we will have better programming in place, and we'll be more responsive to the conversations that we have with our student athletes.
That is Athletics Director Larry Lyons of Illinois State University with Eric Stock. Lyons is set to retire at the end of December. He's been with the university for 33 years, the last seven as AD. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker.